will cost $100. And if you want yours computerized, it has dials on it you can use. If you want to put the computer on it, the computer is an extra $40. And I have one of those here if you're, any of you later are interested in looking at it. It's a full alphanumeric computer that will allow you to enter about 200 rates and their names into it, and it's about the size of a credit card, except it's twice as thick. This is cutting-edge technology. We picked this one not because of its size and shape and alphanumericity, but we picked it because we can pick the signals out of the back, convert them into a serial signal, and use it in the machine for tuning the radionic machine computerized, in a computerized way. So those classes are going on. Right now we're at the capacity of having them at Andy Anderson's house. And I'm going to do one of two things. Either we're going to have classes Friday night prior to the first Saturday of the month, and then the following Monday, and break it down into two groups. Or depending on the geolocation of people interested in these classes, I'll do one out here in the valley, one at Andy's, and one in Orange County. So any of you who are interested in getting involved in that class, I'll have a sign-up sheet. And we're going to have that class is continuing at Andy Anderson's at 6 o'clock this coming Monday. There are these classes. I'm going from here up to San Francisco. I'm doing the same class for over 100 people in San Francisco each month. And we have 80 people that were at the class last night in Salt Lake City. A lot of the things that we're doing, we're going to be doing experiments amongst the classes. Some of the experiments we're already doing were covered on 2020 about 7 weeks ago, where we've tried to locate 25 lost children. Out of 25 lost children, as was reported by the head of this group on 2020, we have found 19 children, 4 bodies, and 1 set of bones. So it's becoming very accurate. We're using statistical methods in this. We're proving scientifically that the things that we hear and talk about here are possible. We're building instruments that will pick up impossible things. Another one of the instruments we're going to build is a small device that will fit in your pocket and will totally replicate any $6,000 to $8,000 German electroacupuncture diagnostic and treatment machine. That machine will cost probably, without the computerized version, will cost somewhere in the neighborhood of $70. To add the computer to it is going to cost another approximately $150 to $160. Now, the company that I do consulting work for up in Utah builds a $12,500 diagnostic computer. And I can't tell you that this little pocket thing that's going to cost you less than $400 will replicate that. So I won't tell you that. In Utah, there's been a foundation formed called SEARCH, Subtle Energy Association for Research in Communications and Health. Those of you that know what an SE5 radionic machine is, that company has purchased the international rights to that machine, and they are distributing that machine in mass in Utah, and it's beginning to spread out, and they're doing a lot of very exciting things with it. This is a computerized radionic machine, and it is an exceedingly, exceedingly powerful transmitter or balancer of subtle energies. We've taken people here in Los Angeles. We've measured them with an electroacupuncture machine to measure the voltage potential at the major acupuncture points on the body. Their picture has been in Washington, D.C. We put their picture in one of these machines and broadcast 20 minutes and measured those points again, double-blind study, and absolutely in 20 minutes balanced that person all the way from Washington, D.C. out here. I'm going to be doing a class in the Washington, D.C. area and one in New York City, and we're going to be working together doing a lot of these experiments with the devices that you build. We already have one group, this chart that you may have heard or read about, this supernova that burst here the other day, about, I think it's 2-3 weeks ago. We picked the signals up from that a month ago on these gravity wave detectors. We said what area of the sky it was going to be in and what the intensity was. And the gravity wave detector picked it up. And you can build a detector just like that for basically some of your time and around $25.
But can you debug the embassy in
Moscow? I can see bugs in the embassy in Moscow from right here. Okay. Another thing. I don't know. Does anyone here know the name Ludi Larson? Okay, Ludi Larson is was one of Pete Kelly's number one trainers in the radionics area. She is now doing classes using the SE5, and she will be down here in this area doing a three-day radionic class. At the end of the meeting, I'm going to have to dig in here and find the date and time. You get these three manuals. There's a rate book and two manuals. A manual that she's written. Her area of specialty is agricultural radionics, but she teaches this. There are 12 people total. She limits her class to 12. You get a lot of personal hands-on attention, and if you don't think you can get a stick, you better go to Louie Larson's class, because I'll guarantee you get a stick like your hand fell in the holes in a bowling ball. He's a fantastic instructor. I'll tell you the price of the class, as long as you're seated. I think she's charging for the 3 days $350. For what you get, if you want to learn radionics, that is the best bargain in the whole entire field. She is one of two people that I know that I feel can competently teach this. Now, I think that there, of the people that I know, there are only two people I really know that I trust. One is Francis Farrelly, who I took my training under. The other one is Louie Larson, whose training I've also attended. And there'll be a date and time. I'll have information. I'll have information and brochures on this at the class at Andy Anderson's house. Yes?
It's April 24th through the 26th. And 12 students limited, so you know, if you're interested, call her and let her know that you want to be there.
Do you have her number?
Yeah.
Okay.
801.
785-7416. Now, what's most amazing is that she lives about a quarter of a mile from my office there. I had no idea she was there the first 4 years I was there. And the lady who bought the international rights to the SE5 and Informed Search Foundation lives a mile the other direction. And Wendell Hoffman is up the street. Those of you who know him, he's pretty heavy in radionics. I think that's about all I have. I'm going to pass this paper around. Any of you interested in a class, I'd like to have your name, address, and phone number so we can contact you. This is kept on a computer, totally encrypted. And it's not kept anywhere near my laboratories or where I live. So any information that's sent out, if you get information from Tijuana or San Ysidro, don't be surprised at the address. And that information would be sent out. Those of you who want to show up at Andy Anderson's place, I would suggest you bring a folding chair and a card table. And we'll probably, if very many of you come, we'll probably overflow. In fact, I guess maybe I should ask a show of hands. How many people here would be interested in attending these classes that didn't know about them? Oh, boy.
That many more.
Well, you should probably bring a folding card table and a chair, and what we'll do, if you'll pass this around, if you'll put on here Valley, Los Angeles, or Orange County as a preferred location, we're probably going to split this up. We'll either split it into two nights, or we'll actually split it into geolocations. Yes? At this point, I have no idea. It may be we would even have it here. Yes?
Los Angeles is where it already is.
It's actually in Highland Park. It's up the, slightly out of Los Angeles, up the Pasadena Freeway, a couple blocks off the Pasadena Freeway. In Orange County, we would probably have it somewhere down around either Orange or Anaheim near the juncture of the 5 and probably the 22 freeway, somewhere that would be very easy for a freeway access from most any direction.
What's the cost of this class?
The classes cost there's $5, which pays for the room, unless we get an expensive, have to get an expensive room somewhere. $5 for the class, and if you buy the kit, that $5 is taken off the cost of the kit. The kit for the gravity wave detector is $25. Now, that doesn't include a box. If you want a nice little box for it, the boxes, we'll cover that. They're being machined tonight, And I'm thinking they're going to be the box and then another little special part you need to go with the box. They're probably going to end up being around $10 or $12 extra. Now, being as this is really a non-profit operation for me, I'm interested in getting this material out and to the hands of the public. I try to cover my airfare at least. I would appreciate those of you who come to bring cash rather than checks, because out-of-state checks in Utah take from 30 to 45 days to clear. Okay, out-of-state checks, if I was banking right out here, all those years I lived up in Topanga, I was taking for my out-of-state checks that came in, the banks, both Bank of America and the Independence Bank, were taking 30 to 45 days to clear out-of-state checks. Now, that's against the law, but the banks don't give a damn about the law. They give a damn about making interest on your money.
No.
No, not with the banks, brother.
Have you done any work in e-fuel pacers?
Yes.
What results did you get?
There's a lot of confusion about the time next Monday night starts.
6 o'clock.
Now,
wait. Okay, for those that want to show at 6 o'clock, we're going to do it at 6 o'clock. For those that want to show at 7, you won't miss anything. Now, you don't think that's true, but that's absolutely true. You won't miss anything. It's just that the people that show at 6 are going to get to hear it twice. And it would, if some of you can show up at 6 o'clock, it would be very helpful, because then when those show at 7, guess who's going to be assistant instructors? Are there any other questions? Oh, we'll talk privately about anything else. I'll give you the. Oh, you have Ludi Larson's phone number. If you want to take the class, you must call her and register. I think she has about 7 or 8 openings left. She just started this, and there'll be just a few left. I just had a couple of the people that are doing research with me with SE5s attend her class this last weekend, and they. In fact, there were two of them who couldn't go to the class, and had her do special consulting for them at $150 a day, and they just didn't think they wanted to pay it, so they just had her for half a day. They've now had her for 4 days at $150 a day, and he called me and he says, "This is the most wonderful thing I've ever done." And this is a fellow who was a hyper left-brained type individual who could not even couldn't get a stick, couldn't even imagine getting a stick, and he was getting soil samples and blood samples within 1% on the third day. So there's some very exciting things going on. She's in Pleasant Grove, but the class is going to be held down here. And I'm going to dig through all the things I threw in here to get on the plane and come down, and I'll tell you the address. It'll be down here.
Who is your contact person in San Francisco?
In San Francisco,
The reason I'm asking is because we have the whole lab expo coming up the next weekend, and I will be up there. Thomas Brown will be up there, and if we are lucky, Eric Dollard will be up there.
Yeah.
And I like to spread the word. You know, that would help you, and that would help the.
Okay. Well, I'm going to be on a panel discussion there at the Whole Life Expo.
Are you?
With we were supposed to have David Bohm, and he may still make it. Elizabeth Roucher, and a couple of other really interesting folks on that panel discussion. So I'm headed from here up there. That'll be Friday night, and on Saturday we're having an all-day SE5 training class. On that Sunday, which is Easter Sunday, I believe, there's something other going on that's rather interesting. Yeah, the Dalai Lama has a new quarters that's very near San Francisco, and we're going up for a dedication of that. His main building has 500,000 copper roof tiles about this big and a half an inch thick. They're all hand-chased like fish scales. And he has a 207-foot solid gold dome that's been built, and that's been up there for about 2.5 years. Nobody's known about it. There are 300 monks that have been praying 24 hours a day for that period of time, and it's now approximately Easter time going to become holy enough for him to use it. and
is it near San Francisco?
Pardon?
Near San Francisco.
Near San Francisco. You flew from San Francisco north northwest and got to the point that you were inland from the ocean, approximately 9 miles. It's sitting right on top of a mountaintop, and it's about 22 miles of dirt bike trail to get there.
Is he coming over here primarily to help us? Is that his idea? What? Why is he here?
You have to ask him.
Yes.
Yes. David Bohm, by the way, has just agreed to come for a year sabbatical to Temple University, so he'll be here in the United States for a year at Temple University. Right. Yes. He was supposed to be there, and the problem is we don't know if he's going to or not. He got that stupid 12-day or 24-day flu thing that's been going around. It was going to be a kind of a surprise appearance. There are a few of us that know him that, you know, that knew he was going to be there, but he's going to try to make it. It's the Whole Life Expo, San Francisco version. I believe it's at Moscone Center Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Not this. We have a feeling that those people up in Utah that know have a feeling that this flu that's been going around is something that got loose from a government laboratory.
Amen.
We have found absolutely nothing. Absolutely nothing will touch it. Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean that stuff's passe. I'll give you a good formula if you want to.
What about AIDS too? That also got loose in
never mind. I won't say anything. Thank you.
With radionics are finding the information. Is after I find the information, we're able to trace the problem, whatever it happens to be, back to its original source. And I was working with a man just this past weekend, and his problem was authority figures, and he had never been able to work with people. And we started tracing it back, and it ended up going to his father, to his grandfather, to his great-grandfather, and he was suddenly able to see and feel things that were happening with them in their lives that he had never seen or felt or was only vaguely aware of from hand-me-down stories in the family. He was also very concerned that his father did not love him. And we picked this up at about age 5 because we used the arm muscle testing to take him back to the age. And we use other techniques so that he can easily remember things that happened at that time. And all of a sudden he felt the love that of his father towards him that he had never felt before. And since then I have talked to him recently, or this week, because this just happened last Sunday, and he says it's changed his whole feelings towards all his 4 children that he has. And his wife is dead and he is having to raise the 4 children alone. And he's become much more sensitive. So although this, like, the radionics can home into what a problem is and when it happens, there is also techniques with it to what we call diffuse the emotional energy on the original problem so that it no longer causes you problem in present day. And I've got some brochures here for anybody that would like to know about my workshop. I passed quite a few out at the Dowser's meeting, so some of you already have these. And I'll just put a few on each table and pass for you to pass back. And I'm very interested in seeing what's happening next.
Thank you, Virginia. Pete, want to take over?
Just quickly, I did find this information on Louie Larson. I do not have the address, but it's going to be in Rosita starting at 1 o'clock on the 24th. From 1 o'clock to 8 o'clock on the 24th, which is a Friday, and then 9 to 5 on Saturday, 9 to 5 on Sunday, 9 to 4 on Sunday. $350, and you should have an instrument to attend this class. Now, if you don't, she rents an instrument for $100 for 30 days. And if you purchase an SE5 from her, there's $150 that she takes off of the price of the class. And if you want another number, I don't know which number we had, 801-785-7416. You get the three Kelly manuals plus Ludi's own manual, her training manual, and it's a superb manual, and like I say, it's tremendous training in radionics.
I didn't get that.
Kim Davis, it's yours.
Okay. You were going to tell us what it was, but...
No, I think that's more fun if you do it.
Okay. I have a few things to say first. The Integratron sounds so great. I think we should all get behind it, and it could maybe eliminate smog if we could find some source of energy. And maybe it's not my business to say this, but let's all look for sources of funding for this. It sounds like one of the best things, you know, that we could possibly do.
Kim?
Yeah.
Almost cannot hear you.
Okay. All right. Janet Layton here has introduced me to a couple of people in this area. I might be working here instead of in San Diego as planned. We do have a physician here tonight so that I can legally demonstrate what I'm doing and what I can do with this equipment. It's not having the equipment that matters. Anybody can go out and buy this stuff. But there are some techniques that are being developed now for such things as removing genetic problems, removing viruses such as slow viruses that affect a person for decades and they don't know what's wrong with them. There has been good results with removing Agent Orange from veterans and with rejuvenation of tissue. And I won't get into all of that now because I'm not treating or diagnosing or curing here. This is research and it can only be done in a doctor's office. But I can at least demonstrate tonight what this can do. I'll just share this with you. I brought back a very large and expensive ozone machine, which I am selling, if anyone is interested, along with about 250 pages of German instructions, which I am trying to translate. And it's slow. Well, let's get started. We have a volunteer. I don't remember anything about you, but you said that your problem had been. So would you please let us in on it?
Pardon me?
Would you like to tell us why you wanted to be demonstrated on tonight?
Well, I put a gun to his head. I told him he's a funny old treasure hunter, and if he don't sit in that chair, he's going to be in big trouble.
That covers that.
Well, I got all kinds of problems.
You were fine.
Two electric dipoles, inductor heads, that carry information from his own body. In other words, there is no artificially generated frequency coming from this instrument here. The magnetic field is a carrier for it, and it makes it about 16 times more effective. The magnetic field carries the information from his body into him. And you might say, well, it's already in his body. Who cares? The difference is part of the information from the electrodes is filtered into compatible frequencies with health, and those are amplified, and part of them are not compatible with good health, and those are canceled out. This is just basic. He does this for 2 minutes, 2.5 minutes, and then we go on to something specific. So is that it? Just
moving his head.
It's okay. It'll fall. To an extent. Okay, so on the magnetic field.
Since I've had that operation on my nose, I have to go back to taking Ritalin. Before I had dexedrine and amphetamines. Eventually it kills you.
Well, I can
I can't take dexedrine and amphetamine since I've had the bypasses. But I can take the Ritalin.
Because with heart patients, you want to go slowly. There's only a limit to what we can do at any one time. Can't do too much. But if there is a problem like you suggested, where you have an operation and then suddenly your medication changes and your whole life changes, very often it's because a wild protein is formed, meaning that the anesthetic may form an amino acid that looks like, that's okay, this can stay on. The other one I turned off. And it appears, it resembles a natural amino acid, but it's not quite the same. And it affects genetic things in the body, and you have problems that you didn't have before. You can't tolerate certain things. So it is possible to make that cell eject the amino acid that has the anesthetic or the penicillin or whatever shouldn't be there in it. If it's not ejected, then an autoaggression phenomena occurs, which means that you have an immune system attack on your own organs. And they would rather kill the cell than tolerate that foreign substance in the cell. If the cell cannot eject it, that's what happens. So that might be, I just don't know. That might be your case, but that's one of the things that they're doing in Europe now. His cards are available up here. He's very well known. He's a pioneer in acupuncture. He's been beaten down by the establishment, and this lady could probably tell you about that. Janet Layton. Yeah, and he's written a book. But rather than mention his name on tape, I'll just say his cards are here if you want. So that should be enough for you. Now, if I wanted to take the time, I could measure all 20 of his meridians before and after, and you would see an enormous change just from 2 minutes. When it was tested in Dr. Roy Martino's office, we tested all this equipment on physicians, and we only gave each one of them 2 minutes. And after 2 minutes of treatment, their biological age had dropped by two factors, which is about 6 to 10 years. It is not permanent unless you continue, but that's an indication of what you can do with it. And I'm just beginning to scratch the surface. I've been studying this for almost a year, and I've just begun to scratch it. There's a lot more to be learned. Well, it depends on your energy situation. Some people, like myself, are so sensitive that if I walk over and touch this tape recorder, all my meridians are no longer balanced because I've had problems since birth. But other people are so resistant to change of energy that it just lasts and lasts. That might be the only time they ever need to be treated. And the only way you can tell is by continuing to measure it with this equipment. And the measuring equipment doesn't lie if you do it right. It's very impressive. You can measure unbelievable things. You can find exactly the organ in your body that's causing the trouble. You can trace it down. It can cause a chain of events leading A, B, C, D, and E from, say, the bile duct in the liver to the pancreas to the prostate. That's a typical one. Or in women to the ovaries and the heart, believe it or not. And you can locate it. So it's very useful, and I just wish that it were possible to say more, but I can't.
And if you'd be kind enough to tell us names for these pieces of equipment that you have here that we might recognize the next time we hear of it.
Okay. This is Vega Mora Indinet. It's basic electromagnetic therapy. And there are others that I use, too, that I didn't bring, mainly because one of them weighs 110 pounds. Indinet. It stands for induction medicine. It's Indinet. Does anyone else want to try?
Yes.
Okay. Yes, you. With a strange shirt.
I designed this shirt my very self, actually. I was on the island of Bali at the time. And was having a wonderful look.
That eliminates geopathic stress. I had a biological tissue age of 21, which is what you expect from terminal cancer patients or people who are about ready to slip off this plane. And Dr. Martino measured that, and then I did the deradiation for geopathic zones, and 3 days later he measured me again, and it was 13, which is, about half. still not real good, but it was a lot better because I was on a double grid zone and a lot of things were happening. He is an expert. He's a leading world expert, and I trust him implicitly. So when he says that he's never seen anything like it before, believe it. Dr. Roy Martino.
Where is he?
Right now he's in Europe. He'll be back. But he's going to start a clinic in Curaçao, the Netherlands, and Tilly. Were you unable to hear me in the back of the room?
Yes.
Okay. Basically, this is electromagnetic equipment. The bottom one, which Pete here helped develop, doesn't have any technically or artificially generated frequencies in it. It's all your oscillations. Every part of you is vibrating at millions of different rates. And the interesting thing is your genes can resonate and read those rates and be activated, but they can't read them all at once. It's like trying to read a whole book all at once. So this sorts them out and does certain things to them so that your genes can read those rates. And it's not radionic, but it's I guess the best thing we've got right now.
Body electric.
Yeah.
Where is that place you said the doctor might be at eventually?
His cards were up here. I just 2 days ago, Jacqueline Layton here introduced me to someone, and I was going to work in the San Diego area, and it just seemed like I could hardly tear myself away from these things that are going on up here, the psychotronics meetings and the dowsers and everything.
Yeah.
No, I guess
here's
we're
one
out.
Card. There's one,
okay.
There's one
yes.
left.
There's one left.
Oh, thank you. There's that one
left. Okay. Oh, thank you.
But if Rona says anything, we're just good friends, right?
Okay.
You want
so, it's not settled yet. For rectangular waves, this is a microprocessor, and it's just analyzing the wave at various times. And also there are two pulses, two different frequencies that are set in the magnetic field, in addition to all the ones that he's getting from his own body. There are three or four things that can block this kind of treatment. And one is if you have heavy geopathic stress, that will always do it. And so that's why I got that little device that gets rid of it. The other that will block it is a focus of infection, which you may not even know about, but you can test it and find it on this instrument here. And if you have internal scarring, that's another one that can block it. But these are the same things that would block any kind of energy medicine, whether it's touch for health or homeopathy. Anything that changes energy in the meridians would be blocked by these same things. Scars, focus of infection, or geopathic stress, generally. There's a few other conditions, but that's about it. So we have to look to other instruments to take care of that, and sometimes surgery, but it's rare. This takes care of an awful lot.
Love affairs gone wrong are a very big source.
Box flower. That's the way.
Yes.
7:30 in the morning in the Santa Monica area. And on that, I wanted to ask Bill Moore if he has any update on the word as to what the government is doing with null gravity testing.
Well, that's a whole new area of discussion. Null gravity or anti-gravity seems to have been an interest for a long time. I've been involved with the study of that largely because of the interest I took in Townsend Brown's work, who's been perhaps one of the foremost people in that field for the last 60 years. In fact, recently discovered a research report which the Navy had done on Townsend Brown's electrogravity device, which we'd known about for a long time, but nobody could ever find the thing. And I found it, retyped the entire thing, and I have it available now as a publication.
Oh, great.
If people will write to anybody interested in anti-gravity, just write to me in Dewey, Arizona, and I'll send them a flyer on that. I felt all along that there has been an interest in governmental circles on anything dealing with anti-gravity propulsion. And I think that that's perhaps increased, if anything, over the last few years. I know of at least two people that are involved with that subject at a government laboratory. They don't talk too much about it. But curiously enough, one of the things which has popped up recently in the list of items which is a no-no to release information about, I guess I ought to explain that a little bit, classification of government information is essentially ruled by the sensitivity of the information involved. Certain things that you don't talk about because you don't want your enemy to know that you're working on them.
Of course, yes.
Because if they know you're working on them, they're going to work upon it on a defense against them. And, you know, if you tell your friends, you're telling your enemies, so to speak. And if they can develop a defense, then what good is your project? So in that sense, there is a government, Department of Defense publication which lists specific areas of information which are to be safeguarded. That is, nothing goes out without close scrutiny first. And on that list, recently, I've noted the appearance of electromagnetic propulsion systems.
Like the old submarine.
Like the old submarine, which was developed by Dr. Fred Way up in the Santa Barbara back in the 1960s. No moving parts.
And it moves through the water like a shark.
Went through the water like a shark, working only on electrical power and electromagnetic force against the salt water.
And why haven't we had any more testing done about that, folks?
Well, maybe we have, but we just don't know about it. One of the things that I think is tragic about Mr. Brown's work is I think that he was on the right track. But I think that what happened was that he posed a security risk because of certain health problems.
Oh,
and so they could not involve him directly. What they did was monitor his research, and any time he came up with a good idea, they started exploring that, too.
Sure.
They went right around him.
That's what they should have done with Tesla.
Well, I think they're doing it with Tesla, too, now.
Right.
But of course, we should have been
doing that 70 years ago.
That's right. Tesla certainly is emerging as a genius.
I don't want to take up a whole bunch of time. I have one more thing I'd like to ask you. Have you had a chance to read the Phil Klass book? Is it worth going into?
Yes, I've read the Phil Klass book, and I've had considerable correspondence with my dear friend Phil Klass on that topic. He certainly has a couple of pages in there on the Roswell case. And I knew that he was doing the book and had written to him a year or so ago and offered to do a review of his manuscript, of the part of it dealing with the Roswell incident. And I said, you know, I'd like to look at it and just simply offer suggestions and corrections. And he was incensed. He wrote back just outraged that anybody would even dare to ask such a thing. Why, Phil Klass couldn't possibly ever be wrong, and so how could you just... You know, and on and on and on he went about this.
Sounds like he has a problem.
And so then he came out with his book, and I noted no less than 25 individual errors of fact in the little bit that he's got in there on the Roswell case, which convinced me that he can't possibly have read my book or the three update papers that we've done since.
I see.
So I then wrote back to him and said, look, Phil, you know, this is just disgraceful. And then he comes along and says, well, if I've made so many mistakes, why don't you simply submit corrections? I said, hey, wait a minute. You know, now that the horse is out of the barn, you come along and want corrections? Ridiculous. The book is, I think it's worth reading from the point of view that it makes you so mad that you want to go out and discover for yourself where he's wrong, and then you'll ignore him for the rest of your life.
Well, I've had an encounter with him, at least from a readership end before, and discovered that there were minor errors in some of the things he said, but I'm, at that point, was not a researcher in the field the way I am now, so I have no real way to compare what he said. And I saw this book, and I thought, the subject of deceiving the public is certainly a controversial one in this area, if any other area. And but that's an awful big book, and I'm really short of time, and I figure you would at least know.
It's an expensive one, too. Now, you're talking here about the man, to sum up on Phil Klass, and we'll get on to more important things here. You're talking about the man who, when Senator Goldwater came out and said, yes, there are such things as UFOs, and yes, the government is covering evidence, and I've got a copy of that letter right here in front of me, as a matter of fact.
I think we have one in our files, too.
Phil Klass said Goldwater is getting old and senile and doesn't know what he's talking about.
Oh, good.
So then we dug up a letter where Goldwater had stated the same thing in 1972, when he certainly was not old and senile. Klass is the same man who said that Wilbert B. Smith, the Canadian official in the 1950s, who, and we've got some interesting stuff from his project in the Canadian government, said that UFOs were real. Klass's comment was, can't be, Smith was crazy.
Oh.
Bonkers was the word he used. He's the man who said Jesse Marcel, the intelligence officer at Roswell, was prone to a gross over exaggeration and sensationalism, because he would dare say that he was present at a crash saucer site. He's the same man who's accused me of being an outright. He said in print that I was one of the most unreliable people in the UFO field, and I challenged him to prove it. He hasn't been able to do that. In fact, I said, find me one instance where I was unreliable. He hasn't come back with me on that one. This is the same guy who, in every case where anyone has made an attempt to bring forth evidence and that Phil could not refute, he's gone back and said, this person is crazy, or this person is unreliable, or he's dug some skeleton out of their closet to show that they're probably just not well. And he tried in November of this past year, when there was a UFO conference in Nebraska, at the University of Nebraska, he called the university officials and accused them of abetting the communist cause because they would sponsor a UFO conference on campus.
Oh, boy.
This is the guy that we're talking about, and I'm not sure that he's worthy of much more discussion on this program.
I think I'm going to save myself $12.95 or whatever it costs.
Oh, $17.95.
17, is it? Oh, well, good. Okay, yeah, that's... one short thing. Do you know anything about the reliability on the reports of... working relationship between scientists on the Spanish government staff and a race from some place out there called the Humos?
Well, anything that I've ever been able to find out on the Humo affair smells pretty poorly. I don't have any evidence in that case that convinces me that there's anything to it.
Well, we've got a report that says there's some aspect or some department of the Spanish government made a film based on new optical principles introduced by the Humos and the subsequent experimentation therefrom, in kind of a montage effect showing what the Spanish scientists were up to with the new Humo information. But we can't find out whether or not the film is in actual existence or a spurious report, because the Spanish government, through their embassy, at least here in Los Angeles, refuses to comment on the subject.
Well, I guess I can't comment on it because I don't know anything about that aspect of it. I'd like to know, perhaps privately, what the source of that story is, because sometimes that's a key as to the reliability of the story.
Very true. Which leads me to, our research staff would like to extend an invitation to you and to Stanton to get together with us a week from tomorrow night and see if we can't exchange notes on a meaningful level.
Well, I think that's something we can discuss off the air.
Okay, fine.
All right, I'll do that.
Very good. If anybody does have a report that they think is worthy of somebody looking at, why, they can feel free to send it to us. That's Group 680, care of Interstellar Technical Research, Post Office Box 701, Venice, California, 90294. And don't hesitate. You may think you are silly. You may think your friends won't believe you. We'll look at it. We'll read it. We'll give it some strong consideration. We need to have people come forth and say, hey, I really saw a weird-looking thing, and I think somebody should know about it.
While we're on the subject of looking for reports, I'm looking for a report. I'm interested in any information regarding unusual objects in Southern California on the night or evening of December the 13th, this past December, 1983. Anybody that has anything unusual on that particular night, I'd sure like to hear about it.
Okay, we've got one on November 15th. And that's our Santa Monica report.
There have been some things going on around here.
Sure they have, folks.
Okay, Evan?
All righty, Bill. Thank you. With the government and the Army, because they saw Army...
Yeah, I'm familiar with the case. What's your question?
Well, the question was, in this article, it said that this is the first case where they have filed suit against the Army and the government to try to find out more information on that. Are you familiar with the lawsuit on that?
Yes, very familiar with all aspects of that case. In fact, I was the first investigator called on that case, and I put it in the hands of the people that are dealing with it now.
Oh, I see. So it's probably a pretty good case then.
It appears to be on the surface, and I guess we're going to take a break here. Is that right?
That's our walking music. Yeah.
Let's get back to that question right after the break, briefly at least.
You want to hang on for about 6 minutes, everybody?
Sure.
We can get into that.
Sure.
It's a good one. Mike asked about a rather interesting case down in Texas. You want to continue along with the subject there?
Yes. The case in question was the Cash Landrum case, Betty Cash and Vicki Landrum. And... a young boy, I think he was 7 years old at the time, Colby Landrum, in December of 1980, driving home at night after dark, encounter an unusual object above the highway, stop the car, get out to look at it. It's bright. It's essentially obstructing the road ahead of them. It appears to be in trouble. There's a loud roaring noise. Flame comes out the bottom. Suddenly a bunch of helicopters appear around it. And it seems to get control of itself and takes off across the tree line. They don't know what it was. They're terrified. They think one of them thinks it's the second coming. They just don't know what to make of it. They get home. They experience physical symptoms, which... are quite similar to, in many respects, to radiation poisoning. And they continue to experience physical effects now 3 years after the fact. Quite serious physical effects, as a matter of fact. And the question at issue, of course, is just what is it that they saw? Where did the helicopters come from? The number of independent reports verifying that there were helicopters in the area at the time. The road surface was damaged. There was damage to some of the vegetation in the area. And all of this, of course, makes for a what's going on here type case. Certainly they saw something. The medical effects were caused by something. And the case was investigated largely by John Schussler in Houston, Texas, who is the assistant director, deputy director, of MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network, one of the three major national organizations that deal with UFOs. MUFON has about 900 members, I guess, worldwide, publishes a journal, and has a local chapter here in Los Angeles, as a matter of fact, that's sponsoring this get-together next weekend at the Culver City Civic Auditorium, Saturday afternoon, 1 to 5. And we'll talk some more about that later, but back to Cash Landrum. Schussler did what I would consider to be a credible investigation in many respects, in that he covered a lot of territory in a short amount of time, but he, being only one individual, seemed to have skipped a few points, I guess understandably. But... the result was that the Air Force instituted an investigation of their own, or at least they claimed that it was an official investigation through the Judge Advocate General's office and the Inspector General's office, trying to, in essence, get themselves off the hook. And they concluded that they could not show government involvement in the case. They could not produce any evidence which would indicate whose helicopters were there. That's point one. At that point, Peter Gersten, a New York attorney, got involved with it and filed a complaint against the Department of the Air Force on behalf of these people, claiming that the government was responsible at least for the injuries and medical treatment of these people, because they were citizens and because the government had an obligation to protect its citizens against whatever this thing was, since it had caused damage. That claim was rejected on the grounds that Gersten had totally failed to connect the injuries, which they didn't deny, with anything which was sponsored by the government. They didn't deny that the incident occurred or that the injuries had occurred. They simply said, we're not responsible because you haven't produced any evidence indicating that we are responsible. And threw the burden in his lap, you see. He appealed that, and in September, a ruling was issued by the Judge Advocate of the Air Force upholding the initial denial on the same grounds, that Gersten had failed to in any way implicate the government in the occurrence. And until he could show that they, in fact, were responsible through some action on their part, they claimed that he had no cause of action. And I know that his intention was then to appeal that into federal court in a civil matter and trying to gain judgment against them, against the Air Force. And I assume that he's done that, but I don't really know for certain if he has. And I really have some problems in wondering whether he's going to get anywhere with it, simply because if, in fact, the government was involved in any way, he's going to have one whale of a time in trying to prove it. If they're going to cover it, if they're not going to produce information, and there's certainly provisions within the security and classification procedures which allow members of the military intelligence or military projects to deny the very existence of these things if disclosure would affect the national security.
This takes a short session with the judge.
That's right. And it's happened in the past. So I'm very sympathetic to the problems that these people are having, and I really wish I could do something to alleviate them. But at this point, I don't see a whole lot of hope unless somebody comes out of the woodwork and says, hey, it was the government was involved in this thing in some way, and here's the proof, here's the connection, here's the evidence, and is willing to testify on that behalf that the evidence is authentic. So we're left with a question. Did they see a legitimate UFO? And was some unit of the military aware of its presence, and did they send out what amounted to 20-some-odd helicopters to try to intercept it? And is that what the helicopters were doing there?
Or were they there to help it?
Or were they there to help it, which, of course, is another question. Or, and I feel, I tend to lean more in the direction of a second alternative, and that is that what we, in fact, have run into here is the test of some secret project-type vehicle, which may be nuclear propulsion, and which went out of control and threatened to crash, and they said, hey, guys, we're going down, and the helicopters were sent out to cordon the area off and try to recover the object and keep the public away from it. Now, we know that there has been considerable interest on and off in the area of nuclear propulsion for use within the atmosphere since 1946, going back to the old NEPA project, Nuclear Energy for Propulsion of Aircraft, NEPA. And that, that's almost 40 years ago considerable research was done, and then the thing slowed up in the 60s, late 60s. But it's possible somebody made a breakthrough and that we, in fact, have developed a nuclear propelled craft, and that it was on a test mission and went out of control, and that's what happened. I tend to believe that that is more realistic in this case than the fact that they encountered an illegitimate UFO, simply because of the circumstances. I think that that tends to be more credible. You don't send out 26 or 25 CH-46 helicopters, Chinook helicopters, CH-47s, I guess they are, after a UFO. You send out a fighter interceptor.
Yeah, they're not going to be very effective against...
Yeah, you don't send out Chinooks loaded to the gills with personnel. You do that if you're going to cordon off an area. If you're going to secure an area and try to protect the public from going in and protect the security of the project involved, then you send out helicopters full of people. But if you're after a UFO, in every case, you send out a fighter interceptor.
Does that help you, Mike? Okay.
Okay, bye.
Thank you for hanging on. Craig, you're on the line now.
Good, boy. You know, you've got a real double bill going tonight.
We'll ignore that.
Bill square.
Okay, that's all right.
I have enough trouble with my bills, thanks.
Listen, I've been very interested in the Freedom of Information case suit that was filed, I believe, in 1979 or 80, and went all the way up to the Supreme Court, I believe, several months ago. They finally denied the request on, something like 700 or 800 different documents, and I surmise from your presentation tonight that you are the right person to ask about this.
Sure, what do you want to know?
Well, as much as you'd like to say.
Well, if you could make it a little more specific, I'll try to answer the question.
Craig, you usually hold in better than that.
Okay, why don't you just give us a couple of minutes of what you think are the most pertinent facts regarding this lawsuit.
Well,
and the information that was being sought.
All right, and what you want is a general overview as opposed to some specific questions. Yes, I in fact was part of that lawsuit. I was one of five speakers at a press conference at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. when we went to the Court of Appeals with it. I'm on the board of Citizens Against UFO Secrecy, which is the agency that filed the suit. It was filed in 1979 against the National Security Agency, that NSA again, never says anything, people, they had responded to a Freedom of Information Act request saying, yes, we have documents, no, you can't have them. And so we went into federal court in the District of Columbia with an appeal of the denial. And the judge said, all right, gentlemen, how many documents are we actually talking about here? We thought we were talking about 15 or 20. And the spokesman for NSA said, 135. And the mouth has dropped open. So, now that's documents. That's not pages.
Right.
A document might be 100 pages. It might be one.
Right.
We went on about that. And the argument was made that the public had a right and need to know, and that since the government's position had always been that UFOs don't exist and don't constitute any kind of a threat anyway, there certainly couldn't be anything classified about information relating to them that might be in the files of any government agency.
Really?
And so Judge Gerhard Gesell ruled, well, he heard the case in September of 1980, at the district court level, and issued a ruling, which I'm madly trying to locate because I've got a copy of it here, and as he thumbs madly through his papers trying to find it so that I can quote directly from it, and you'll hear me shuffling here. There it is. Judge Gerhard Gesell ruled in November the 18th, a ruling of November the 18th of 1980, essentially the following, and I'm reading right from the ruling here. Throughout the court's review of this material, the court has been aware of the public interest in the issue of UFOs and the need to balance that interest against the agency's need for secrecy. The in-camera affidavit, I'll get to that in a minute, presents factual considerations which aided the court in determining, and here's the key part, that public interest in disclosure is far outweighed by the sensitive nature of the materials and the obvious effect on national security their release may well entail. Wow. Here's a federal judge saying, hey, folks, you can't have this stuff because if we were to give it to you, it would create an obvious effect on the national security.
Now, isn't it possible that they were referring to the release of information that would reveal surveillance techniques
and
capabilities?
That was their argument. But let's go a little further here.
Right.
What do we mean by the in-camera affidavit? Well, the judge, as was his right under the Freedom of Information Act, requested copies of the documents in question to review in camera, in chambers, in order to make his ruling. The NSA came back and said, no, you cannot have this stuff, but we will give you an affidavit presenting our reasons why you can't have it. And so they presented the judge with a 21-page top secret UMBRA, UMBRA, which is a classified restricted access type thing above top secret, stating their reasons why the judge couldn't see this stuff. And it was on that alone, he never saw the documents, that he issued this ruling. Well, then we went into the appeals court. And we said, we argued in front of the appeals court. And I was in court when the argument was presented to a three-judge federal panel. That the lower court had erred in its ruling, erred in the sense of made an error, in that they had not reviewed the actual documents before making the ruling, as required by the Act. And the three judges heard the arguments. The government attorney, who was one of the assistant attorneys general, get my grammar correct here, made the comment in the hall to our attorney that she, in fact, had seen the 21-page affidavit, top secret, and that she wasn't about to talk about what was in it either, but that it was extremely interesting. Well, we were informed that the court normally took 60 to 90 days to hand down a ruling in cases like this where a procedure was involved, probably near to 90 days, and that a ruling would be handed down, we would be informed what it was. And so we sat back, prepared to wait 3 months. 5 days later, the court handed down a ruling, almost as if they had already decided the thing, which said, hey, folks, the lower court was correct, and we are not entertaining any arguments that that this should be reversed. So we went to the Supreme Court with a petition in 1982, in January, to the effect that, please, you know, this certainly ought to be reviewed, that an agency of the government should not have the right to withhold information and then withhold even the reasons from the public as to why it's being withheld. And so the petition was presented to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court reviewed the petition in March of 1982, which is nearly 2 years ago now, and on the 6th of March, handed down a ruling which, in essence, said there is no issue of substance here, and therefore the ruling of both lower courts will stand without review. Well, that's where it's set. All right, now what are we left with? We're left with two alternatives, trying to find out what they're withholding. So we file a Freedom of Information request for the 21-page affidavit. And we got it. We got 21 pages of blacked out lines, just blank. 80% of the material in that 21 pages, totally censored from the release.
It's fascinating reading, Bill.
It's really great if you like. And you get a copy of it if you want to write to me in Dewey, Arizona. It
takes about 2 seconds to read the whole 21
Well,
pages.
A little more than that, but it certainly is there a cover-up? Hell yes, there's a cover-up. The question is, what's being covered? So then Moore gets involved with this thing and says, all right, there's got to be a back door here. We've got to find out how long has the NSA been involved with this thing. Do they have, what kind of documentation do they have? How long have they been interested? So what do I uncover? I go through the back door and I start pulling out intelligence files from the Army release, for one thing, 900 and some pages. And I found in that the Army release no less than 106 individual reports of unidentified flying objects filed under communications instructions relating to vital intelligence sightings by all branches of the military, And I've got several of them right here in front of me. From 1952 through 1956. And believe me, the file I've got is by no means complete. And who's on the distribution list for every one of these reports? But NSA. Every one of them went to NSA, as well as the CIA, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and, you know, a variety of other places, including Naval Intelligence. And here's one right here I'm looking at, which is dated, gosh, what is its date? Now, I'm looking at it and don't see a date on it. Ah, there it is, 12th August 1954. Stare at it and don't see it. 1954, distribution, CIA, Director NSA, Joint Chiefs of Staff, Situation Room, Air Force, Army Intelligence, etc. Note, this message has been relayed to CIA by electrical means. It says right on the bottom of the thing. And it's a report of an object observed by the tower radar and by visual observation in Maxwell Air Force Base, Alabama, 1954. Well, I've got 105 of these things. I'm there in the early 1950s. What does it say to me? It says to me that NSA, which was established by executive order of President Truman in 1952, was receiving UFO information from day one, 1952. And if I've got 105 of these things, and this is just spotty reports from the early 50s, and they're only claiming they've got 135 documents, somebody somewhere has slipped something. Now, why is this stuff going to NSA?
I would assume that what you've got, what you've been able to get a hold of, doesn't even begin to compare with the stuff you haven't been able to get.
Oh, I'm sure of it, because this stuff is classified, you know, confidential, restricted, a few of them are secret.
Yeah.
It's like pulling teeth to hit, to get what you have.
Yeah, but, you know, you go in through the back door and you suddenly find out that they've been getting this kind of report for a long, long time.
Is a lot of this information going to be covered in the upcoming book, Clear Intent?
Well, I think some of it is. I'm not sure that they have as much information as I have, and they've been dealing mostly. That's Larry Fawcett's book, Clear Intent, done with Barry Greenwood. I know Fawcett pretty well. Greenwood, I've met once or twice, but I really don't know him too well. And that's coming out in April from Prentice Hall Publishers. I think April 1st is the release date on that. If I'm not mistaken, April Fool's Day, of course, has nothing to do with the book. But Larry is pretty thorough. They're dealing mostly with the Northern Tier incidents in 1975, when there were a number of, a whole flurry of reports of unidentified activity over the Northern Tier air bases along the U.S.-Canadian border. And I've got considerable documentation on that subject as well, a reprint of which is available on my list of items which you can get if you want to write to me. And you can read those for yourself. But I think Clear Intent deals pretty much with that. I don't think they have copies of this material from the Army Intelligence file, because I was the one who discovered it, and I haven't sent them any yet. I just got it myself.
Listen, before I let you go, I'd like to ask you one other question. What do you know about sightings in, number one, the Philippines, where we have Clark Air Force Base and Subic Bay Naval Station, the largest of their type in the world, and number two, sightings in Australia, where we have the Pine Gap Station. I believe that's an NSA operation.
It certainly is. I do know that there has been a recent flurry of activity in Australia. Last fall, November, December, lots of activity down in Australia.
In fact, a flap is still going on.
I think it is. Yeah, I still get some spotty reports from down there. But I don't have any real good details on it, because it's just not something I've been working on. I collect the information, look at it, and say, gee, that's very interesting. But I don't have time to do, you know, I'm one person.
Any comment on the NSA connection there?
Well, no, because I don't know how much connection there is. Certainly, they've got an enormous facility down there.
Yeah.
And certainly, if they're getting any kind of data, it's coming back here. There's no doubt about that. As far as reports from the Philippines, I do have some copies of early ones. Some of this material I was just talking about from the early 50s contain a few from the Philippines. And I don't offhand have enough of that just at the tip of my fingers to be able to cite you a specific case, but I do know that I've looked at a couple of those reports, and that's where they came from. getting back to reports that went to the NSA, here's a short one, which is not a Philippine case, but I'll just read it because it's so short. 21st August 1953, from Flight Service Hamilton Air Force Base to Director of Intelligence, U.S. Air Force, etc., at 1335 Pacific time, reported unidentified flying objects, and they give latitude, longitude, and so on, appeared to be in formation, then break up and, get this, fly in circles around aircraft. Appeared to have mass of fire in rear.
Flying in circles around aircraft is quite a trick.
That's a neat trick if you can do it, especially in 1953.
Any self-respecting glob of swamp gas can do that, Bill.
Yeah. Now, where did this go? Did it go to Project Blue Book? Which, of course, was the Air Force's official project at the time. No, it didn't. It went to the Director of Intelligence of the Air Force. It went to the Army, the Navy, the Joint Chiefs, the CIA, the NSA, and the OAC, whatever that was. 21st August 1953. Now, that's just a sample of the kind of stuff that is in this file and that NSA was interested in getting copies of. Lord knows what they were doing with it, but from the date of inception, 1952, they're getting this kind of stuff. So, you know, are they covering up methods and sources as they claim? And that's their argument. We can't give you this stuff because if we did, so-and-so would know that we had intercepted their transmissions of it and they'd change their codes and everything else. And we said, fine, we don't want any information at all which would reveal that kind of information. Take out the places, the names, the dates, paraphrase the information. All we want is the basic UFO data itself. You can censor out anything at all which deals with the place of happening, the sources, materials, and methods, and we're not interested in those things anyway. And they came back and said, we can't disclose this stuff anyway. They wouldn't even give us the dates. Now, what's the date of the document disclosure? But they would not even give us the dates of the documents. And in fact, when they came back and argued to the appeals court, suddenly the 135 documents which they'd been talking about suddenly appeared in print as 171. So it had grown again.
Does that help you, Craig?
Well, not enough, of course. We'd like those documents.
Sure would.
Wouldn't we all?
Listen, Bill, I want to thank you for some very provocative programs. I'm going to be moving at the beginning of February, and I don't know if I'll talk to you again before I move.
Oh, we're going to miss you, Craig.
Well, you're going to be around on the 28th, and you certainly can show up down here in Culver City.
I wish. I just hope that you're going to get this program on the network soon enough so I can get it in Northern California.
Well, we certainly hope so, too.
Okay, thank you much.
Okay. Very bright young man who calls in quite often. We'll get right back to Bill Moore and our callers in just a moment. I'm Bill Jenkins. It's Open Mind. Hello, everybody.
There's many, many ways that we know that that Blue Book simply was not the end of the line. Let's take a brief look here at a memo written in 1969 by General Carol Bolander, Brigadier General, U.S. Air Force, who was Deputy Director of Development and Research. And he's writing a simple memo on the subject of UFOs, unidentified flying objects, 20th October 1969. And what does he say? If Blue Book, which the public has been led to believe all along, was the end of the line for UFO reports, then why would a brigadier general say something like this? Moreover, reports of unidentified flying objects which could affect the national security are not part of the Blue Book system. And then he goes on to say again, in the same memo, however, as already stated, reports of UFOs which could affect national security would continue to be handled through the standard Air Force procedures designated for this purpose. Now, 1969, you know, Blue Book was on its way out at that time. And here's General Bolander saying reports which could affect the national security never went to Blue Book. They were handled outside. They're not part of the system.
I think you have some documentation that involved J. Edgar Hoover, in fact, in the investigation of crash
UFOs.
Well,
he was complaining as far back as July 15th of 1947, just after the Roswell case, that the Army Air Force was not cooperating with the FBI in sharing information with respect to disks recovered. He specifically says that.
Mm-hmm.
And he's complaining about, in a specific instance, they would not even let our people have a cursory examination of it. And, you know, he personally wrote that on the bottom of a rather innocuous memorandum, sort of petulantly complaining that these people weren't letting him in on things. And, you know, that brings us to another point. Is there still classified information about UFOs that has yet to be released? We've seen at this point in time, under Freedom of Information, probably between 5,000 and 6,000 documents that have come out. The great percentage of which are just garbage. They're newspaper clippings or they're internal correspondence that deal with the, which is nothing. But about 10% are more than just of passing interest, and a very small number of them actually say something. None of the documents yet released bears a classification, original classification, higher than secret, with the exception of the heavily censored NSA affidavit we just talked about. Were there top secret documents? Because if there were, if we can find any evidence at all that those things existed, then certainly something has yet to come out. Here's a memo from January of 1949, and I'll just read the pertinent part. At recent weekly intelligence conferences, and I'm going to paraphrase here, the matter of unidentified aircraft or unidentified aerial phenomena, otherwise known as flying discs, flying saucers, and balls of fire, have been discussed. And then the key part of this. This matter is considered top secret by intelligence officers of both the Army and the Air Forces. In black and white. Top secret. In 1949. Where are those documents? Where are those records?
They're still top secret.
They're still top secret. We haven't seen anything from that time frame or later which bears that kind of classification. We've seen confidential and restricted and even a few secret, but we've seen nothing above that.
Mm-hmm.
Are they still collecting UFO reports? Here's a regulation, current regulation, from JCS Publication 6, Volume 5, Joint Chiefs of Staff material. Current regulation. This report provides for the peacetime reporting of intelligence sightings of vital importance to the security of the United States and Canada. What do they want? What kind of sightings? What material? The following specific sightings will be reported. Hostile or unidentified single aircraft or formations of aircraft which appear to be directed against the United States or Canada or their forces. Clearly, unidentified aircraft. Missiles. Hostile or unidentified submarines. Hostile or unidentified groups of military surface vessels. And, as a separate category, not unidentified aircraft, unidentified flying objects. Current regulation, right out of the JCS publication for 1983, do they want reports on UFOs which might affect the national security? There it is in black and white.
The Joint Chiefs of Staff still work on it then.
The Joint Chiefs of Staff are collecting reports, and where do you suppose they go? NSA.
And to the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
Oh, and to the Joint Chiefs.
Shall we go to another caller here, see what is on Dan's mind? Dan?
Hello.
Yeah.
Hi, Bill.
Mm-hmm.
Hello, Bill.
Hello.
Listening to all this stuff, I think it's fantastic that you folks have this information. You must have done a tremendous amount of research to get all these documents.
Well, I'm not going to brag about it because it's not something to brag about, but unfortunately, the UFO field is such that there just aren't a lot of people doing research more than on a part-time basis. And somebody pointed out to me on a show a couple of years ago that I must be the only full-time a professional journalist who deals full-time with UFOs in North America. And I thought about that for a moment and says, well, by golly, I think you're right. There isn't anybody else. I sometimes wish that wasn't so. That's not an honor. That's a disgrace. There ought to be dozens of people into this field, but there aren't.
I absolutely agree. And personally, of course, I you might say as another, again, part-time researcher, you know, things that you do in the evening and after work. And I've been involved in doing this kind of thing for a couple of years. And I've read your book. I've read numerous other books and articles. And you start getting a picture that, for instance, going over your book, I was just, you know, one of my favorite parts of your book is a letter from Gerald Wright to Ben Lane in California about the, you know, the incident that occurred as far as Ike having to survey his craft. And all the scientists apparently pretty much in chaos and confusion, etc. But, you know, even since then, there's so much information that's come out. Leonard Stringfield has a horde of reports about crashed saucers or landed saucers. There's a number of people out. For instance, a guy called Virgil Armstrong. Are you in contact with him?
Well, I know who Virgil is. That's not his real name.
Okay, well.
But, yes, and I've got some real problems with some of the material that he has come out with, but go ahead.
Well, there seems to be so much information coming out, and especially since this Roswell incident occurred in 1947, which is 37 years ago, I have a feeling that, although, of course, there's a lot of information to be taken out of the government, that the government is very, very much playing with us, too, because 37 years ago, if they got hold of any type of craft, and they've been doing kind of research at least for 37 years ago, the advances that they have made are just so way beyond anything that we could probably even come up with right now. Even think, you know, we're still trying to get at the government has come out with papers that flying saucers exist. I have a feeling that the government has done so much research that they're so far ahead of us that we're not, you know, the questions we're posing to them are the same kind of questions we're still posing in the early 50s. Now, where do you think the government has gone at this point, as far as their own research is? If Leonard Stringfield is right as far as his information is, there's been tremendous research and probably advancements. I mean, you don't stop, you don't stay at one position for 37 years.
Well, that's a tough question to answer unless you have some inside information. Let's take it apart at the seams and deal with it on specific issues. First of all, if we can buy the idea that we've got a crashed craft in whatever condition we recovered it, and certainly there's a great deal of evidence that that is the fact. I've talked to something like 90 different people who have substantiated that story in one way or another, and 30 of them firsthand. That's an awful lot of people. You know, you get one or two witnesses, that's one thing. But 30 different people who essentially don't know each other telling the same story and saying, yep, that's what it was. I was there. Seven of them handled bits and pieces of wreckage. Two have claimed to see bodies. You know, that kind of thing. that's pretty spectacular. Excuse me. We have a Canadian memorandum all the way from 1950. This one was top secret, but it's Canadian, not U.S., and it somehow slipped past a couple of the Canadian government people. I don't feel that it should have been released, because I think they read page one and didn't read page two, and that's what happened, because on page two, it says, I made discreet inquiries through the Canadian embassy staff in Washington who were able to obtain for me the following information. The matter of UFOs is the most highly classified subject in the United States government, rating higher even than the H-bomb. In 1950, that was 2 years away from its first test explosion. B, flying saucers exist. C, their method of operation is unknown, but concentrated effort is being made by a small group headed by Dr. Vannevar Bush. Now, there we've got the guy who seems to have been the leader of the technological team that got into this thing. And D, the entire matter is considered by the United States authorities to be of tremendous significance. Now, here's a top-secret Canadian memo from 1950.
1950.
Making a statement like that. And, of course, they never intended for that kind of a thing to get released. But if we look into Vannevar Bush and who he was and what he was, and that's a long story in its own right, we find that he was just the individual that you would have chosen had you been in a position to choose anybody to handle that kind of a project. We've got another guy coming forth just recently, scientist, PhD, who knew Bush and who's said on the record and in writing that Bush indeed was involved in a thing like this and that there were bodies and that there was a project going on at that time and that he wasn't part of it, but he was aware of it. And this is a guy who was one of the dollar-a-year men back in the 40s during the war and so on, prominent scientist, well-known, now up in years and retired, on the record with that kind of a statement. We have Senator Goldwater, who comes along and says he's made inquiries trying to get this kind of information. And he's given up because nobody will give it to him. This is Goldwater writing, this thing has gotten so highly classified, even though I will admit that there is a lot of it that has been released, it's just impossible to get anything on it. Senator Goldwater, 1981. Senator Goldwater, 1975, made an effort to find out 10 or 12 years ago, he says, in 75, what was going on at Wright-Patterson. And I was understandably denied this request. It's still classified above top secret. Senator Goldwater, in 1983, I have no idea who controls the flow of need to know because, frankly, I was told in such an emphatic way that it was none of my business, that I've never tried to make it my business since. Now, this is a guy who was candidate for president of the United States making a statement like that. 1983. what do you make of something like that? Clearly, the project is going on. Somebody is interested. If they got a crashed craft, somebody was interested in technology, and I think that's the reason for secrecy today. The technology, of course, may be so far ahead of us, even now, what's 35 years? Sure, we've made great advances since the war in 1945. But if that craft was 1,000 years or 5,000 or 1,000,000 years ahead technologically, we're still not going to make any kind of a dent in what the thing was. It's like handing Thomas Edison a microchip and saying, here, Tom, tell us what this is, what it does, and see if you can make one like it. And that's only 100 years ago. It's not so far back. There are my favorite analogy of landing an F-18 or F-19 fighter plane in a crash landing one in a field outside of Washington, D.C. in the middle of the Civil War, 120 years ago, technologically speaking and historically speaking. How long does it take Lincoln's best scientists to figure out what it is, how it works, duplicate it, and put one in use against the Confederacy? With the technology of 120 years ago, absolutely impossible. And that's not so far back. You know, that's only a few generations back in time. Let me change the subject just briefly and encourage all of our listeners out there, first of all, to get on my mailing list. If you want information about documentation, publications, and so on available, write to me, Bill Moore, Dewey, Arizona, D-E-W-E-Y, Arizona, 86327. And if you can't remember the zip code, don't worry about it, because Dewey, Arizona is only one place. It's a small town, and I'm the only Bill Moore with a mailbox there. So just write, and if nothing else, say, put me on your mailing list, and I'll sure do that and send you out some information telling you what's available, how you can get copies of some of this stuff that I've been talking about here tonight. The other thing is to encourage everyone out there, and if they all showed up, we'd be in trouble, would we, Bill?
Yeah.
To come to the What's New in UFOs seminar, which is next Saturday afternoon, January the 28th, beginning about noon and going on till about 5 o'clock. Stanton Friedman, myself, one other lecturer, Civic Auditorium here in Culver City, Veterans Memorial Building, Civic Auditorium, corner of Overland Boulevard and Culver Boulevard. And there is an admission, $6 at the door.
You got three bills. Hello, Bill.
Bill Moore.
Yes.
This is Bill Steinman. I stayed up late for a change to talk to you, just because you're talking about my subject matter.
Well, you usually talk to me early and wake me up in the morning, so in this case you're talking to me late. How are you doing?
Fine. I was going to bring up the subject matter, but you already touched on it, about the Canadian connection there with a... with our Wilbur Smith. You didn't get into detail about Wilbur Smith's memo, the letter that he wrote, his research notes, which talked about his discreet inquiries he made prior to the memo that you just mentioned that came out.
That is true, and I purposely avoided that simply because to get into that would take a great deal more time than we have, but I can point out that it is covered in a paper which I presented, and I'm sure you're aware of that because you were one of the people there, Bill, called UFOs Uncovering the Ultimate Answer. And that's available as a publication. Again, if you write to me, I'll send you a flyer on that one. And that goes into the Wilbert Smith thing. The newest thing, and I'm glad you brought him up again because that gets me back into it. The newest thing is a memo by Smith dated August 10th, 1953, which I just got. And, in fact, I was going to call you on this one tomorrow morning, but you beat me to it.
Send me a copy of it.
I'll give you a copy of it, sure.
Okay.
In which Smith says that we have concluded that a significant number of the sightings are probably due to some kind of vehicles and that we can get a glimpse of the technology which makes them possible. We do not claim that the case for alien vehicles is proven by any means, but we do believe that there is sufficient evidence to warrant a scientific investigation on a reasonable scale to find out what these objects are and how they operate. Now, this is, of course, Smith talking to the Canadian government about his own activities and about his own findings with respect to UFOs on the Canadian scene in 1953, and concluding, based upon the study that they had already done, that there was a high probability that some kind of extraterrestrial vehicle was involved, and urging the Canadian government to do something more than they were already doing with it.
Wasn't Smith already convinced